When I was in my second year at college, I decided I needed to shake things up for myself. I went on a 5-day solo trek into the woods, 5 days by myself. It wasn't really that adventurous. I mean, I had a big backpack that I'd paid a significant amount of money for, and it held all those things that I needed. It gave me warmth, it gave me shelter, but still it was an exciting experience for me, 5 days solo. There were precious mornings by trickling streams. There were meals of bread and peanut butter. A whole lot of bread and peanut butter. There were long, long evenings listening into the deep darkness, listening to dogs once barking, it felt like miles and miles away. There were piles of rocks that I had to scurry up, that I kept losing my footing on, that I was sure I would break my ankle on, but I didn't. And one of the evenings on my solo hike, there were other people there. And that was wonderful, because I was getting kind of bored by being alone. What did I learn on my 5-day solo hike? It wasn't what I thought I would learn. I thought what I would learn is that I could make it alone, that I didn't need anybody else. What I learned is that I was never alone. Not once. Not even in the darkest moment of the darkest night. Even when I was the only human for miles, there were creatures, there were rocks, there was the moon, the wind through the trees, there were my thoughts, which moved endlessly. And there was, though I didn't have a name for it yet, there was the holy, which I breathed in as awe and which I breathed out as exhaustion. Which I breathed in as peace and which I breathed out as love. And which I ate as peanut butter. Truly, there is something about food, when you need it, when you truly need it, that sticks not only to your ribs, but to your soul. You've had those meals before, right? It's not the fancy meal in the restaurant. It's not that perfect meal that you have planned for all day. It's when you are so hungry because you've been running around in circles all day or because you couldn't get any food and you finally have that piece of bread with a piece of cheese on it, and it tastes like heaven. This week, I sent a note to you, to our congregation, that I plan to finish my time here in June, that I will be moving on to serve a congregation with my husband, Reverend Scott. It's also a congregation that's much closer to my parents' home. My note said, and it is true, that I will miss all of you terribly. That it aches to go, but that it is time for me to leave, to set off, not solo, with Reverend Scott and with my heart forever holding you. You will be cared for by a new minister with new gifts, but you will also go with me, just like peanut butter does. Stuck to my ribs, stuck to my soul. Because the holy meals that we have shared, and I mean that metaphorically, the holy moments, they are forever my sustenance. It feels perhaps like I am setting off into the wilderness. That's another name for New Jersey. Into the unknown. Perhaps it feels that way to you as well. Perhaps this is your first Sunday and you're wondering, what's going on? We are all in wildernesses all the time. Whether things are new for us or whether we have choices to make, we are always facing wildernesses in our lives. Perhaps wilderness is how it feels to be an American today, with the current challenges in our nation. Wondering how to respond to Syrian chemical gas attacks on civilians, wondering how to make good on our promises to heal our environment or to heal the divides between Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and so forth, in a place so challenged with the antagonisms of difference. And perhaps it also feels like a wilderness to we Unitarian Universalists, because we are challenged to be our best selves, challenged to live our first principle, affirming the inherent worth and dignity of all, even as we are aware of our base and real limitations. What other wildernesses are we walking through? Perhaps the wilderness of grief, when we realize that life with a dear one will never be the same, but it will be. Perhaps the wilderness of a new hip or knee, learning how to walk again. Perhaps the wilderness of not knowing, of needing to make a choice and praying that we choose well. Wildernesses abound. It is a blessing that this is the season, then, of Passover, a Jewish time that remembers the Exodus. When I hear Exodus, I hear first Bob Marley. I feel freedom, I feel release, Exodus, movement of the people. But Exodus isn't a beach party. It's a walk, a long walk through a deep wilderness. That's what Exodus is. When the Israelites set out from bondage in Egypt, they wandered for a long while in the desert. They were escaping Pharaoh. I'd rather you not think of me as Pharaoh. But if it works, go with it. They set out for freedom to make a home for themselves. They brought provisions with them. They brought matzah, that unleavened bread, the flat bread that didn't have enough time to rise. I also think it was flat bread because flat bread fits much better in your knapsacks. My bread and peanut butter was pretty darn flat by the time I was done with my hike. But the matzah, it didn't last forever. And when it ran out, the Israelites grew hungry and worried, and well, like I do when I get hungry, they got really grumpy. Food they needed. What is food in this story? The Bible is so rich with metaphor. When Adam and Eve, when Abraham and Sarah knew one another, it wasn't just their names that they knew. Knew is a metaphor. Just like food is a metaphor. Food is the story, is the stuff in the story, the holy stuff, the God stuff, if you will, that which sustains us through our times in the wilderness. In the Hindu faith, the early gods were always hungry, and they needed humanity to feed them. In the Hindu faith, the gods needed humanity to feed them. Hold on to that image for a while, because this is a wholly different concept from the omnipotent, all-powerful God of Moses and Jesus and Muhammad. The Hindu gods would starve without humanity. Now that's an interesting concept. So the burnt offerings were the food for the gods. Also, good karma, good acts were also food for the gods. I find this quite beautiful, the idea that the good we do sustain something beyond us. It's quite beautiful, perhaps, because it's true. When the Israelites are hungry in the desert, their cravings are not alone for bread and wine, but for a spiritual sustenance, something that can hold them steady as they wander through the unknown, through the questions. The Israelites are hungry and grumpy, and they grumble. If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out here into this desert to starve. Would they be fed? Will we be fed in our wildernesses? As the story goes, when the Israelites were in Egypt, they were slaves. They were fed, but not spiritually full, just full enough to produce the calories necessary to put mortar to bricks, so they could sweat and toil, So they could fulfill brute purposes, but not spiritual purposes. Out in the desert, they have the opportunity to truly taste food, to feel its spiritual purpose like that peanut butter. Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you." And if they were Unitarian Universalists, they responded, "Great, please make it whole wheat, organic, and have some gluten-free." As the story goes, in the evening, the holy brought forth quails, and in the morning, this strange manna, this manna stuff appeared. It sounds like crackers to me, but since it's flaky and white, raining down from heaven, some construe it as holy dandruff. When I say some, I mean Reverend Scott. So the people go out each day and they gather enough. They gather enough. And then, hopes the God of the story, they will know that they are not alone and that somehow there will be not only enough, but plenty. And how is there enough? This is where the story gets interesting. As they gather, some gather more, some gather less. But in the spiritual realm, it is meted out evenly. Some gather more, some gather less, but in the spiritual realm, it is given evenly. How does that work? The story says, some gather a lot, others too little, but then each family has what they need. If you are raised on the Christian story of the loaves and the fishes, you'll see a real resemblance here. In the story of the loaves and the fishes, Jesus has been preaching and teaching and going on and on and on and on and on for hours. You know how sermons go. And the people are hungry. They are hungry and they are poor. Only a few loaves and a few fishes are brought forward for the meal. And 700 or more souls, they hunger. 7,000. 7,000. But somehow the food is divided evenly and all are fed. The community, it cares for its own. It gives, it takes only what it needs, and it gives. It is a spiritual truth, a truth with a capital T, a spiritual truth that there is enough now and always, even in the wilderness. I watched something so beautiful the other evening when I shared my news, my departure with our board of trustees, I watched as the board members resolved to commit to one another and to our congregation. They knew that they would be tasked with the work of securing our congregation's future, finding an interim minister, a minister that will serve our congregation for 2 years, and then building a search team to secure the next settled minister. But they did not grumble in their hunger. They turned to one another with love. They did speak openly about their grief, and I was so blessed by this testimony. Tegan, especially you. Especially Tegan shared a hard and beautiful truth, which you are really good at. You know that? She said, "Don't tell us yet how good it will be. Don't jump ahead to the future. We are here now," and I'll add these words, "we are here now in the wilderness, and it hurts. Let us be here." And then she turned to others with her also profound beauty to serve. Don't laugh. It's true. And if one of those Hindu gods was watching the board that meeting, she was fed. All we need to do is to turn to one another and we will be fed. You will be fed. The food comes to us in our work for one another and for what is good, always and forevermore. I was raised with the tradition of the Passover Seder, that Jewish meal to commemorate the Exodus from Egypt. I'm half Jewish and half Catholic. That's how I got here. The Seder plate, it sits in the center of the table, and each section, it holds a portion of the ritual meal. And it is a ritual meal, meaning that each bite of food has a spiritual purpose, so that when we leave the table and say that we have been fed, it is not just our bodies, but our souls. Some call the body-soul split false anyway, false in the first place, And as a chef turned minister, I'd have to agree. The body and the soul are one. James Stafford, a member here, gifted me a wonderful book on the yoga of eating. I found this quote from the environmentalist Wendell Berry inside. He says, "The idea that we live in something called the environment is utterly preposterous. The world that environs us, that is around us, is also within us. We are made of it. We eat, drink, we breathe it. It is the bone of our bone and the flesh of our flesh. So when we eat what is spiritual that is around us, it comes within and it holds us from there. When we eat of the Seder plate at the Passover table, we eat of the bitter herbs dipped in salt water that remind us of bitter times. And we drink of the wine. We drink of the wine, a lot more wine than I usually drink. The first glass is the glass of freedom, the next is salvation, the next is redemption, the last is togetherness. Yes, that's four glasses of wine. You can drink grape juice to save yourself from the sillies, but many drink wine, as in Judaism, it has a ritual significance. One Seder, when I was still a child, one of the Seder participants had a bit too much of that wine. And instead of reading her next line properly, which is from the fruit of the vine, she read, slurring a bit, from the fruit of the wine. And the whole table erupted in laughter. What I remember best, though, is that our laughter did not stall there. Every year after that, as we gathered, we remembered that slip, and we laughed hysterically again and again. Around the Passover table, we eat the bitter herbs, we drink the wine. Perhaps we even taste some of that manna, that holy stuff that is rained down to hold us in times of wilderness. So this is the end of the Passover story. This is what the holy told them. Take an omer of manna. An omer, O-M-E-R, of manna, and keep it for generations to come. An omer sounds spiritual, right? It's one of those words that we don't know at first, so it must be spiritual. It's either a swear word or a spiritual word. It's actually just an outdated way to say enough. Enough for each and every one. Like an ounce or a ton, whatever a family would need, an omer. It's just a weight, an amount. The word omer reminds us that enough and plenty are spiritual realities. The food that we eat together, the meals we make of worship, the hymn sandwiches, the service projects, the blessings, the meditations, the memorial services, the weddings, the humor, the love, the love, the love. My soul, our souls grow deep on these spiritual foods. May this omer sustain us in each way for generations to come, and may it always be meted out to those who have not yet found us, but seek sustenance deep down to their bones. In the words of Marley, speaking about the Exodus that the Jewish people knew and the Exodus that the Black people knew and the Exodus that perhaps all of us know, Marley says, "We are going to walk through the roads of creation, through the tribulation. Open your eyes and look within. We know where we're going. We know where we're from, even in the wilderness. May we taste Exodus." Amen.